Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Jeff K will be here to talk about Barack Obama's torture of people. I know, they say that he banned it, but... Well, you know, like a lot of things with that guy, it ain't all what it was cracked up to be. And you know what? If you've been listening to the show all along, then you know about Appendix M, the loophole. And, well, geez. Here I go already wanting to spoil the whole story. We'll get to it. That's the great Jeff K. from dissenter.firedoglake.com. How the press, the Pentagon, and even human rights groups sold us. I wasn't sure if that said U.S. or not for a second. Sold us an Army field manual that still includes torture. And okay, so Jeff K. will be on the show to talk about that. And also Adam Morrow will be back on the show. He's, I guess, one of IPS News' reporters in Cairo. And today's election day, if you can call it that, it's a referendum on the new constitution, which is already a foregone conclusion. I might as well make the interview a foregone conclusion. The Constitution's a foregone conclusion. It was written by the military. It's made to pass. But what all's in it? I don't know. What's it mean for the future of Egypt? My shoulders raise in a shrugging type of emotion here. You can't see it, but it's true. But Adam Morrow's going to be on the show, and I like that guy. He's smart. I don't always agree with him on everything, but that's all right. Don't have to. He'll be doing some good reporting here from Cairo in just a little while. Also, tons of news. Tons of news. First of all, 1 in 4 Americans satisfied with direction of U.S. 23% of Americans say they are satisfied with the way things are going in the U.S. at this time, unchanged from December and within 1 percentage point of the 24% average for 2013. So now, the question actually is, in general, are you satisfied or dissatisfied with the way things are going in the United States at this time? Yeah, that's pretty vague. In a way, they're sort of asking, do you have a job? Are you doing all right? Do you think that you'll be able to keep it for the medium term? Okay, yeah. That's what a lot of people are answering anyway. Yeah, I'm doing all right. Got a new truck. I don't know. But then again, you know, it's really a deeper question, isn't it? And of course, it begins with undefined, but pretty much, strong implicit conflation of the country and the government and its policies. You know, for example, they say right here, this month's reading is 7 points higher than last year's low of 16% in October, which came during the government shutdown, but is lower than the April 13th high of 30%. So anyway, which isn't that funny, right? When everybody's lined up to pay their taxes, that's when they like the way things are more, huh? Or maybe that's just because they get the rebate and they think that it's free money, not realizing that the government has been holding it without interest for a year for them. Without asking. I don't know. But anyway, here's my thing about it. There's a lot to be dissatisfied with as far as the direction of the United States as a country, as a society. And there's a lot to be very happy about as well. I'm not going to lie about that. It's just that's not what this show is about. This show is about the bad stuff. And the bad stuff is almost all rooted in the Empire. And sometimes it's not immediately obvious as to why that is. Like, for example, we have a bad economy. Well, people go, well, war is good for the economy. Even in the middle of a bad economy, even after 10 years of war, you go, well, war is good for the economy. Because I heard that a bunch of times in a row. And the fact that I'm living in a bad economy in the middle of a war, I don't know. People just believe that stuff because it gets told to them all the time. But the thing of it is, it's not just that the money is all wasted. It's that the economy suffers these terrible shocks because of all the war spending. And here's what I mean. All the war spending is deficit spending. And they got to get the Fed to create new money to buy their bad debts all the time. So that's what they do. And if you look at what happened right after September 11th, Bush and Greenspan conspired to lower interest rates to nothing. And to just turn on the money machine full blast. Instead of that leading to some kind of Weimar Germany hyperinflation across the board for all prices, what'd it do? It shot up prices in the stock market bubble and in the housing bubble and in the fuel markets and the cost of groceries, in fact, because of the fuel. And anyway, all of that inflation, the reason that they created a gigantic fake bubble, the fake prosperity of the boom of the Bush Jr. years, was because they needed to make the wars seem free. Now, if they had to raise everybody's taxes by 1% for the mission to kill only bin Laden and Zawahiri and then end the whole war or something reasonable like that, then people would be willing to go with that. But if they want to declare a whole new excuse for world empire and bonus wars of, you know, invasions and occupations that cost trillions and trillions of dollars, like with the Iraq War, well, you can't raise people's taxes for that. You got to, in fact, if you're George W. Bush, his people anyway figured out what we ought to do is send everybody a $300 check in the mail. And make it seem like that's their dividend. That's their, you know, their cut from all the profit we're making from invading Iraq. But then the pain comes due with the crash of 08 and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars destroyed and the entire global economy disrupted and uncounted by anyone. Lives ruined, businesses gone under, families torn asunder, kids killed in foster care, and God knows what. And the horror of the economic collapse of 2008 that the whole world is still having to live through. And all the destabilization on the very personal level all the way up to the nation state level that comes from the military spending. And you know what? It's just like Alan Box said, the day that, or 2 days after Saddam's statue fell, on my first interview show back in 2003, he said, man, and you know what? Look at what war does for family values. This is something conservatives ought to be especially concerned about. Everybody has their slogans about all our military idols and how superhuman they are and whatever. But the truth is they come home feeling guilty and many of them kill themselves. Many of them come home to find out that their girls, their girlfriends, their wives have moved on without them. Or that they missed the most young and precious years of their kids' lives and are a stranger in their own home. Or, you know, have all kinds of PTSD symptoms from watching all their buddies get blown up next to them and God knows what. I mean, you read about it all the time at this point. The suicide rate in the military is much higher than the combat rate even for the Afghan war. And so, you know, the people who are actually the most willing to buy all that claptrap about family values and militarism going hand in hand, their families are the ones that suffer the most. Never mind everybody else's from that same economic dislocation that I'm talking about. And then, of course, there's the police state. and the militarization of the cops. And we're going to talk about some more killer cops on the show today. In fact, here in a minute. But here's the question that you should ask every time that you hear that a cop killed somebody. You should ask, was that cop a veteran of the Iraq War? And was he trained on Iraqis? How a cop is supposed to treat his suspects? That's what I wonder. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Gallup.com. 1 in 4 Americans satisfied with direction of U.S. And so I'm just making the case that militarism is at the root of most of our worst problems. And I'm not a utopian type. And I think even if we had an extremely libertarian America, everybody would still have all kinds of problems because that's life. Be a hell of a lot better than what we have now, but still. I don't believe in magic. I don't believe in isms providing, the answers for things, solving all of our ills. But I do know what's wrong. And it's the empire in Washington, D.C. They spend $4 trillion a year. Who in the hell do they think they are? Are you kidding me? Where the U.S. Pentagon and our military spending matches the rest of the world combined. Do you realize that? You ever seen those line graphs? And by the way, all of the other major powers are our allies, other than Russia and China and their frenemies. The Cold War has been over for a generation. You can call them rivals or whatever if you're a collectivist and you really believe there's such a thing as China, Russia, and America. And these are just government lines. There are Americans and there are Russians and Chinese, I guess, but that's because they're people, not because they live where they live. But anyway, there are no major power rivals against America anywhere in the world. The Germans, they're our allies. The British and the French are allies. In Latin America, no one at least is a million years from being able to challenge our power. And you could argue that the Brazilians have some degree of independence from the U.S., although how much independence from the U.S. they really have, I don't even know. I wouldn't dare to try to quantify, but I doubt it's as much as is generally believed. And then that's it. India, again, they're an independent power, but they're certainly no regional hegemon. They're no nothing. So, America spends as much as the rest of the world combined on militarism for what? It's just welfare for people who are in the militarism business. That's all it is. First and foremost, the generals and the admirals themselves and their rich wives with their shopping sprees, their vacation homes. These are the world's worst welfare mongers. And not in quantity, but the excuse that they use, that we need them to kill people so they can have, there's like 5,000 U.S. military golf courses in the world or something like that. These guys have to have golf courses everywhere they wage war. It's completely out of control. If you were from some other country and you were reading people writing about the amount of spending that goes into American militarism, and you were looking at it from an outside point of view, you would be like, what in the world? Those people are crazy. Must be. And then you wonder why it is that your government lives as though it created us. As though all that stuff about America being the land of the free and where these people are our public servants and it's a democracy and a consent of the governed and all that, like they've never heard of that. Like that's somebody else's legacy. There's no tradition of limited power and individual freedom here. No, they own us. You wonder where they get that attitude when we let them spend $4 trillion a year, just every year, year in, year out, $1 trillion on militarism a year. The $4 trillion is the whole government budget, which is amazing. But $1 trillion a year, at least, spent on militarism. Wasted. And not just wasted, but training these people that, yeah, it's okay for them to kill whoever they want. It's okay for them to waste whatever they want. Look at what they're entitled to. They're entitled to start wars. To start wars. You know, like them dastardly Japs at Pearl Harbor. Only from here. They start the wars, and then you expect them to treat you with respect? You know? They shoot your neighbor in the head on the side of the road for nothing. I just heard one this morning. Old man, kind old man, beaten to death on the side of the road for no reason. Just the cops felt like killing him. Happens all the time. And you wonder where they got the attitude that they could do that when we give them license. Unlimited license to do what they want. And look at this, you know, Kelly Thomas, the only reason anyone's ever even heard of Kelly Thomas is because his father was a cop. And he was just some bum, some schizophrenic homeless man who was beaten to death by the police, the whole thing on video, begging and pleading for his life, crying for his father who wasn't there. And the prosecutors, in this case, was so outrageous, and the fact that his dad was a made guy in the government mob meant that they actually pursued charges on this. He's also a white guy. And unbelievably, the prosecutors went after these cops and said, hey man, they don't have the right to just murder people. Even working for me, he argued. And then the jury acquitted him. You heard Will Grigg on the show talking about how the defense's case was, hey man, just because they beat the living crap out of him and then he died doesn't mean that he died of having the living crap beaten out of him. He just happened to have a heart attack right at the time that he was being beaten to death. You prove causation. What? Are you kidding me? Not kidding. And what did the jury do? The jury says, all right, the cops can kill whoever they want. In fact, wasn't this down in San Diego? How many of these jurors are military guys who, you know, practiced night raids on Sunni fighting aged males or those who happen to live in the same neighborhood as Sunni fighting aged males for years on end, who now treat America as the battlefield, just like Lindsey Graham says, just like David Addington and Dick Cheney prescribed. There is no law but that the president is the commander in chief, and everybody down to your local deputy sheriff and your meter maid and the rest of them, they're all just as much imperial warlords as he is, I guess. They all have sovereign immunity. And in the rare case where a prosecutor actually takes the thing to the grand jury, and in the even rarer case where the grand jury goes ahead and it goes on to a petit jury, the jurors actually side with the cops who beat a helpless, unarmed man to death. Maybe the judge excluded testimony that the kid's dad, the guy who was a grown adult child guy, that his father was a made government employee. Maybe if the jurors had been allowed to know that this was a cop's son that they beat to death, though. So what about him? And maybe if a cop murders someone, it counts as a murder if that was the boy of another cop. Then is he a human? Then does he have the right to not get murdered to death? Americans. I wonder, isn't it fun to imagine being the fly on the wall in that jury room? Did anyone argue that, hey man, they murdered this poor guy? Right? You can watch the footage. It's all online. Yeah, America's on the wrong track, all right. It's the militarism. It's the SWAT team mentality between the ears of every sheriff's deputy. You know, all that Andy Griffith stuff is, well, probably never really was true at all. But it's dead and buried now, even as a concept. That a cop is a peace officer. That their job is to protect the rights of suspects from the aggrieved party so that they can get a fair trial. Yeah. Don't I sound like I'm talking about some, you know, colorized movie of some olden days? Well, you see, cops, they're just roving packs of murderers, and they kill whoever they want. Read one the other day about the LAPD who grabbed this girl out in front of a club waiting for the cab under the pretext that she was drunk. Oh, really? She came out of the bar and was waiting for the cab. So they just grabbed her, and from what I read, they just molested her with their hands. Still a felony, you know? Not quite a full rape, but anyway, they sexually assaulted her. And then they just threw her out of the moving cruiser. Well, the store camera caught it on tape in L.A. They just threw her out of the car where she cracked her head and is in a coma. Or was in a coma, is now suing them over this. Just roving packs of criminals. Just think, if instead of a war on terror this whole time, Americans had insisted on a war against police corruption, how a little bit better it might be, I don't know. It wouldn't be that much better, right? They could still do whatever the hell they want, but anyway, it's just amazing to me. If you look at what they did to this Kelly Thomas, this helpless hobo that they beat to death for the fun of it, you tell me how that's not a murder. Other than, yeah, but they got hired by government employees to kill whoever they want, so that's their job. In fact, that was their defense. Hey, that's their training. That's their job. Well, okay. I guess if their job was kidnapping and eating babies, that'd be okay, too. As long as that's their job. As long as it made them strong like the steroids they shoot each other up with all day. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. therefore exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Jeff Kay. He writes at dissenter.firedoglake.com. Dissenter.firedoglake.com. He's a psychologist active in the anti-torture movement. He works clinically with torture victims at Survivors International in San Francisco. And his latest piece is called How the Press, the Pentagon, and Even Human Rights Groups Sold Us an Army Field Manual That Still Includes Torture. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
Fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Sure.
All right. So take us back, I guess, to the afternoon of September 11th. Cheney and Addington decide that the Commander-in-Chief Clause is the only part of the Constitution that's operable at that point, and that the president can torture whoever he wants. But then Bush ended that practice after Abu Ghraib and related scandals in 2005, right?
Right, yes. Well, yeah, absolutely. After the Abu Ghraib... Well, they knew about Abu Ghraib, but it really wasn't until it went public, which it finally did, that on that famous 60 Minutes show, and subsequently in the U.S. public saw the pictures of the torture, that they really began scrambling in the Pentagon, and it became a big scandal to, you know, try and find a way to hide the torture. And in fact, there were tons of investigations that the military did after Abu Ghraib, most of which, in fact, all of which covered up more or less, you know, responsibility for the torture. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the lawyers got going. And one of the things they did, and of course this is concurrent with scandals that were leaking out about CIA torture, of course, too, that was happening in those days. People may forget the torture memos that we know so much about now. They were classified. No one knew what was in them. And stories were leaking out nevertheless, but by 2005, they had already, I've discovered, were making moves along the time that the Congress was putting together the Detainee Treatment Act, which was supposed to address torture, but in fact was finding yet another route in which they could use, as Cheney called it, the dark side against these prisoners. And one of the ways they were going to do it was to hide the torture within the Army Field Manual itself and then sell it to the public as a reform, as a brand new and better way to interrogate that wouldn't involve torture. And, of course, that would work great as long as nobody actually read the Army Field Manual and saw that what was in it.
Mm-hmm. It seemed pretty absurd at the time, the way, you know, of course, with John McCain posing as Mr. Anti-Torture because he was tortured and spilled his entire guts, said it told him everything he knew. So he was, grandstanding and all of that and taking the good guy position versus Dick Cheney. But then, like you're saying, first they made the exception for the torture, or for the CIA there, it was supposed to cover, the Detainee Treatment Act was supposed to cover the CIA and the military. So then McCain takes the CIA out of it, and then they add this thing that says, and, you know, correct me if I'm, you know, remembering the chronology mm-hmm. here, but it seems like then they tacked on, well, oh, I know what we'll do. We'll just, we'll have the law say that they can only do what's allowed in the field manual, but then we'll rewrite the field manual so that they can do whatever they want again. Where, you know, it's just like the Three Stooges on TV. There was nothing, you know, subtle or sophisticated about it or anything. It was the most ham-handed way of keeping torture legal I've ever heard of, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, at the time, I was they had done such a good job that I, at the time, remember reading about it and thought that in 2006, when the new manual came out, that they had pulled the wool over McCain's eyes. But in fact, McCain knew about the rewrite. And at that time, what they intended to have, which was a classified section of the field manual that would discuss interrogation techniques, in other words, torture, that would be used on the detainees, on so-called unprivileged combatants, enemy combatants that weren't POWs. Sometimes one reason, another way they get away with this, by the way, is it gets so legalistic that the public just turns off. They hear people like me saying, well, it's the definition of this, and they're not exactly a POW, so the treatment is different, Geneva 1, Geneva 2, Geneva 3 and 4, and people just go, their brains just glaze over, So that's, another way that they're able to get away with this. But think of it as torture by fine print, really, is that we're going to put out this abstruse document. It'll be public if anyone wants to look it up. But in the fine print of this document, in fact, they stuck the worst techniques all the way towards the end of the document in an appendix labeled M, as in Mary. So I don't know how many letters that is in the alphabet. What is that, about the 13th letter? So after the 13th appendix to this other long document, finally you get this thing. And even in that appendix, they lie about what it is. Oh, this is one other technique we have, one other thing we want to mention here. We're going to call it separation. Yeah, we can, so it starts out by saying we're for the Geneva Conventions, we're for humane treatment of prisoners, all this stuff. You got to get all this approval. And, just to use this, you got to have doctors on site, which should have been a tip-off. Why do doctors have to be on site for an interrogation? But no, anyway, separation is the name of the technique. And there's still a lot of people say, oh, yeah, that's all this is. They're separating people so that they don't, collaborate with other people to cause prison uprisings, or, they can share their stories and so they can lie to the interrogators. But again, you'd have to read the actual text to see what they're talking about. And as it turned out, there wasn't just one technique. It was a number of different techniques that were lumped together and called separation. And they included, yes, the isolation of the prisoner, but not like the segregation that you do of prisoners who are captured for security purposes, but it was definitely meant to help break down the prisoner. Sleep deprivation, and by the way, these things could be extended indefinitely. And forms of sensory deprivation, elimination of all light or elimination of all sound. In fact, if you remember those iconic pictures of the detainees who, in those orange jumpsuits at Camp X-Ray, in the very first days of Guantanamo, whose eyes are covered and they've got earphones, there's no sound, ear cancellation, mm-hmm. noise cancellation things over their ears. That's what they were using on them to disorient, because sensory deprivation of that sort, particularly in an aggressive environment, can cause psychosis, and it certainly disorients and breaks a person down. So there are all sorts of incredibly insane stuff has gone on, but it's all been sold to the public, which is what my latest article on The Dissenter shows, by the press, of which you are an exemplar on the other end of the bad press, showing to sell the fact that, the new army, we learned our lesson from Abu Ghraib, now we're humane. Obama comes along, says, I've ended torture. But, of course, he never did end torture. So it all just is kind of insane.
Well, even the claim that, he issued an executive order saying, I've ordered an end to it, was still different than, I've ordered the government to recognize the fact that torture is a crime in America. It already has been outlawed by the Congress and by bills, passed by Congress and signed by the president. And mm-hmm. all I'm doing is ordering the government to go back to following that instead of not. He already was claiming his own authority to really decide whether people should be tortured or not. And he's decided, nice guy that he is, that at least for now he's claiming that no more torture. But, again, just like under the Bush team, it's all in the semantics. And in fact, just like under the Bush guys, when it was, not even under Appendix M, but just ad hoc under their definitions, they even, you can read, and depending on the context, you could sort of at least understand where they're coming from, where they're saying that stress positions and sleep deprivation and temperature manipulation, that you know, that doesn't quite seem like, you know, the rack or pulling their fingernails out or anything like that. But then I guess even Condoleezza Rice and some of these others wondered aloud whether the combination of all of these things together might really amount to torture, even if you don't think that, you know, a marathon questioning session is torture, or sleep deprivation, or temperature manipulation. If you combine all of those things together, you could do it in a way that, you know, to turn it into a real nightmare for someone, that it would certainly, you know, could amount to torture. Yeah. If you combine them all together, right? And that's absolutely the same kind of things we're talking about. Is this isn't the worst stuff that the CIA and the military did to people, but it's still beyond what was ever considered legal before September 11th anyway, right?
Well, yes and no. For the some of the things they do, legal, was still seen as legal. Even the earlier versions of the Army Field Manual allowed for the use of some techniques known as fear up, which of course is to instill great fear into a prisoner, and emotion down. Like, these are just terms, or ego down, that come from the Army Field Manual themselves. They are the names of certain techniques to break a person down by verbally abusing them, to scare a person and make them very frightened about what might happen to them by the technique fear up, to use isolation. Certainly people, you know, solitary confinement has been used, as we know, in the supermax prisons here in the United States itself for decades now, and in the effects, the deleterious effects of that on prisoners is very well known and documented. And in fact, a number of prisoners who have survived all this and torture victims have stated over and over that the physical torture that they received at the hands of torturers, Australian citizen Mahmoud Habib, who wrote a book about his experiences at Guantanamo, said, you know, here's a man who had been literally, you know, up to his, you know, near drowned, who had been, you know, electroshock torture by, you know, when under rendition, he'd been under Egyptian torture, and he said the worst thing that happened to him was when he was put into isolation and subjected to these psychological, so-called touchless torture techniques, which are the sleep deprivation and the isolation and the sensory deprivation. Mm-hmm. Because these are, here's the thing, there really is, I'm a psychologist, I hope people out there, I know you said this, and lots of times there distinctions are made between physical torture and so-called psychological torture. Well, yes, isolation, but really, it's all physical torture. Right. Psychological torture is just an attack upon the nervous system itself.
All right, now we got to hold it right there and take this break, Jeff, I'm afraid to say.
Okay.
But we'll be right back, everybody, with Jeff K. Dissenter.FireDogLake.com. How the press, the Pentagon, even human rights groups sold us Appendix M. We'll be right back after this.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah: turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Jeff K., anti-torture activist, psychologist by trade, where he treats torture victims. So he knows certainly of what he speaks, and also he's great on the history and the legalities about all this stuff, too. He writes it to center.firedoglake.com. And now, Jeff, we were talking before the break about how no-touch torture, look, Judge, not a bruise on him, could actually be just as bad or even worse than the drown you to death kind.
Right, right. Yeah, before I say anything about that, I just want to correct one thing on your intro to me, is I have worked with Survivors International, but I currently am not. I don't want people to think I'm touting an association I don't currently have.
Oh, okay. But I guess your bio at Fire Dog Lake needs a change in tense there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, okay. I'll get on that right away.
All right.
So, what I was saying, and it's very important, is that the reason that people get PTSD and suffer from psychological torture is because it's so damaging. Why is it damaging? Because it affects the nervous system. Everyone knows, a simple way to understand this is, you know, perhaps you want to learn how to play the guitar. So you start learning to play the guitar. At first it's very awkward and try to form the chords or to do a certain pick of the strings. But you practice it and it gets better. The reason it does is because your nervous system, the neurons in your nervous system, make new connections and stronger connections. It literally grows new things in your new connections in your nervous system, and you've changed your nervous system, and now you can easily play that song. Well, you know, when you deprive, either overload or deprive the nervous system of stimuli and sensations, you also do things to that nervous system. It's bizarre, but you can change, you know. They did experiments, for instance. These were horrific, listeners, I'm sorry, but they were really done by researchers, where they took kittens after birth and puppies, and they put blindfolds on them. And for a certain period of time, then they would take them off after a month or two after they were born. But guess what? They never did learn to see, because they needed the stimuli was necessary as part of brain growth. And when they didn't get it during a crucial period early in development, they never were able to see. They were functionally blind for their entire lives. And that's the power of what you can do to the nervous system. And the evil scientists, and I really do think of them as evil, and psychologists who worked for decades for the CIA and the military, and not just in this country, similar things were being done once upon a time in the USSR, etc., that, you know, and other countries, they studied this and came up with a kind of psychological torture that they perfected, and the CIA itself discussed in their own now declassified interrogation manual, known on the internet as the QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual. It was released by FOIA about 15 years ago, and in there the CIA discusses, you know, very, very graphically, their theory of torture and coercion. They use the word coercion. They don't use torture, but that's what they mean. And how you use it in interrogations. And in fact, if you follow the disputes around torture in this country, they very much mirror disputes within the intelligence community itself about different kinds of torture that you should use. Believe it or not, there are differences among torturers. There are some who, you know, feel that there's nothing like a good old waterboarding, that Dick Cheney kind of guy. And then, and by the way, there were guys, there was a big dispute, and I wrote on this at Fire Dog Lake some few years back now, about the dispute among the SEER organization, which was the survival evasion escape, anyway, program that the military uses to train people to withstand torture. As well, I'm sure you remember, Scott, and your listeners, that it was reverse engineered to be used for the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, mm-hmm. and other kinds of torture which took place in the U.S. military by James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen and their CIA handlers. But now I see I've lost my train of thought. I apologize. What I was mentioning was that in SEER, there was a dispute over waterboarding, and they banned waterboarding, even practiced waterboarding, supposedly to teach people how to withstand it because it was so damaging to the individuals. But the Navy SEER people, They kept it, and they kept it going for years after the other parts of the military had abandoned it because it was too harmful. And there were back and forth memos and discussions and arguments within the military over this. So you see, even some of what we are viewing for the interested readers of newspapers and journals and blogs and documents released by the government is, in fact, a dispute within the government itself. And then, of course, there are those who don't want torture at all. And so it can get quite confusing to, you know, the person just listening to it. But the United, you know, what bothers me the most, and I'm so glad you asked me to be on your show, Scott, is just how much this entire subject has become almost banished from public discourse. And the lies and the shallow reporting that goes on out there about how Obama stopped torture and the U.S. doesn't torture, it's just not true. And something, you know, I congratulate you. The press has to take steps to tell the public what's really going on in their name.
All right, so talk to us about the Bagram prison, because at least it was the case, right, that there were two prisons there, the Bagram prison and then the wink-wink, elbow nudge, over-the-hill real Bagram prison where maybe Appendix M was enforced there.
Right. Well, Appendix M is enforced, is the doctrine of the other Army field manual techniques. Wherever there is a military, U.S. military has control of prisoners. I have to admit, I don't, you know, the U.S. government's made it very difficult to know what's happening at Bagram. And I just haven't done enough of my own research to know. So, for instance, supposedly in Iraq, were not supposed to use Appendix M because these were real prisoners of war. But we do know that, in fact, Iraq prisoners were tortured. They were, in some cases, renditioned out for torture. And we know, of course, from Abu Ghraib what really went on a good deal of the time. So no matter what they're saying is happening in Afghanistan, we don't really know. This is an active theater of war. It's very difficult to get information about what's happening, particularly at Bagram today, which has become a dispute between the Afghan government of Karzai and the U.S. over as they supposedly begin the turnover of prisons and other aspects of the war to the Afghanis, to the Afghan government, not the Taliban.
Yeah, well, yeah, Karzai wants to let everybody out, and there's a big fight over that. All right, but so now let me ask you this. There's a very important article by Jeremy Scahill. Of course, you wrote a whole book about it, too, but there's an article at thenation.com, which anyone can find, called Blowback in Somalia. Oh, no, that isn't it. It's the companion article, The CIA's Secret Sites in Somalia. And it's about a prison, a dungeon, really, beneath Mogadishu, which is run by the quote-unquote wink-wink elbow-nudge government of Somalia, backed by the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command there. And I wonder whether, what are the legalities, I don't know, if, I guess that's probably not an Appendix M issue, but what are the legalities, what executive orders, what OLC memos make that okay? Because certainly, at least the way Scahill describes it, it's not even plausible deniability. The Somalis there are running it on behalf of the Americans.
Yeah, of the CIA. And in fact, the CIA will tell you, well, there is an executive order. I mean, there may be a presidential finding, right, that is directing them in this particular operation. But in general, the executive order that covers them was the one that established the CIA way back in 1947. And, you know, which says that the CIA shall do from time to time whatever the president tells it to do, essentially.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You're absolutely right to point out, and there was a great article, an investigation by Jeremy Scahill, but what it really represents is a return of the United States to its standard SOP, which is we will train and we will help staff at the executive levels and when necessary, you know, intervene to for our client states and police and other militaries, will do most of the torture, right? So this is what they did in Latin America. This is what
back
they did
to the School of the Americas model, I guess.
Yeah. Or the even prior to that, Operation Phoenix,
right?
Which the CIA admitted that they tortured and assassinated over 20,000 people. And the Vietnamese say it goes up to about 50,000. You know, in these provincial reconnaissance, in these provincial units, which were run ostensibly by the Vietnamese themselves, with CIA overlords stationed at each of them and heavily involved. So that's what they like. That's until 9/11, when Dick Cheney says, okay, we'll get our hands more dirty, what was really happening is it's not that the U.S. wasn't doing torture, but that they were trying to, you know, they farmed it out, they did the training, you know, they didn't get their hands as dirty with the blood on their hands, so to speak, exactly. But by after 9/11, they decided to go into the business for themselves and cut out the middleman.
Right.
But the scandals have, to a certain extent, undone that, but not entirely. We can see that what they did is they left a huge portion, the so-called more scientific portion of their torture program, intact. They buried it in the Army Field Manual. They told the country that they weren't doing it. Obama said, I've rescinded all of the memos, Bush, John Yoo, and Stephen Bradbury, but they didn't. There was one that, if you look at their executive order again in the fine print, supposedly abolishing torture in the CIA OLC memos, they didn't do that. What they said is, we will get rid of them to the degree that it isn't consistent with our policy, and
right.
I'm giving it to the Department of Justice to investigate. And, in fact, they left one of the memos intact. What memo? The one that okayed Appendix M.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. Hey, y'all. Good morning. I'm sorry. I need to start turning up the news in the morning. It comes in quieter than the music, which means that when the music comes on, it comes on louder than the news. All right. Well, lesson learned again, but this time for good. All right. So, hey, man. How about that Jeff K., huh? That was Jeff K. from dissenter.firedoglake.com, psychologist and anti-torture activist. And the article, again, is how the press, the Pentagon, and even human rights groups sold us an Army field manual that still includes torture at dissenter.firedoglake.com. All right, good. Now that can go pasted right at the end of the archive thing. All right, now, Alan Butler says, how come you don't play the station ID at the top of the news? I play whatever comes with the news. That's all I know. Wasn't there a station ID? I don't know. I play the whole file, if that's what you mean. All right, so coming up on the show, Adam Morrow from Cairo will be on to talk about the situation. The referendum on the new constitution over there. Exactly what you want to call it, I don't really know. Trevor Tim is going to be on the show tomorrow to talk about the NSA. And then, not sure. I need somebody on to talk about Iran some more. But let's see, I can talk about Iran, I can talk about Israel, Syria, Iraq, NSA. Oh, here's more Syria. I don't have my Syria and my Iraq stuff near each other here. What is this? Oh, and here's more Iraq here. Man, that's just, it's too much. It's out of control. Good old tab kit. I don't know what I'd do without that freaking thing. All right. So let me just cover this as fast as I can. I'll try to keep the moralizing at a minimum if I can and just get the news covered for you. How about that? That would be unique. It's a new format on the show, covering news. White House threatens, quote, action if Iran talks fail. Threats aimed to preempt Senate sanctions. In comments that appear aimed at preempting Senate attempts to impose sanctions and kill the Iran talks, the White House played up the idea of the talks failing on their own, and that U.S. action would follow. We are in a position to reverse any interim agreement and put in place additional pressure, Obama insisted, saying that he was preparing measures for if the talks end without a successful deal. with most of the hawks championing the new sanctions, doing so explicitly to kill the talks. The idea that the talks will probably just fail on their own seems to be aimed at convincing them that no action is necessary to sabotage the process. Administration officials also expressed concern about the Russian government's own plan to relax sanctions during the interim agreement. The Russian government's own plans to relax sanctions during the interim agreement, saying that the deal could trigger U.S. sanctions against Russia and violated the interim deal, even though there were clearly no restrictions on sanction easing in the pact. I don't know. Well, they can express concern if they want. I guess that's okay. Well, there you go. That's a novel and unique argument for Obama. Listen, I'm hardly trying. It's probably not going to work anyway, and so you don't need to sabotage it. It's pretty much a done, sabotaged deal. Trust me, the president says to the Senate. News.antiwar.com. White House threatens action against Iran if the talks fail. And then, you know, we talked about this with Reza Marashi from NIAC on the show yesterday, too. Bernadette Meehan, National Security Council spokeswoman, said in a statement, if certain members of Congress want the United States to take military action against Iran, they should be upfront with the American public and say so. Otherwise, it's not clear why any member of Congress would support a bill that possibly closed the door on diplomacy and makes it more likely the United States would have to choose between military options or allowing Iran's nuclear program to proceed. And so that's pretty tough talk. But then again, it does go to show the double-edged sword of this nonproliferation regime. It's mostly useful not for getting the nuclear weapon states to disarm like they vowed to in the treaty, but for keeping non-nuclear weapon states from going ahead and obtaining nuclear weapons other than North Korea. But you saw what it took for George Bush to force them out of the agreement and out of the treaty. Pretty much everybody else has stayed within it. But anyway, certainly Iran has. But on the other hand, violations of their obligations, whether real or imagined, if there's even a kernel of truth, well, we tried to negotiate and they just wouldn't give in. That becomes part of the argument for war. I guess in my old age, I'm getting very conservative. I fear change. I hate the status quo of America's position, the American government's position toward Iran and all their lies and all their hype and all their ginned up crisis. But if negotiating with them makes it, I don't know what, just as likely that the negotiations will end up being an excuse for more war later rather than an actual, legitimate attempt to reach a deal to preclude such a possibility, then damn. You know, every bit of their uranium is verified to be right where it's supposed to be and not diverted to a nuclear weapon. Why is that not good enough? Instead, we let the Democrats set up the tripwires for war. Remember how many times, it was 10 years ago, but it seems like only yesterday, doesn't it, that all the Republican hawks would say, hey, Bill Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act, making it the bipartisan foreign policy of America that we have to have a regime change against Saddam Hussein one day. Well, one day has come. And even the Clinton administration says that this is how it's got to be. So, in other words, all this falls apart. Even if Obama doesn't attack him, he's still at least making it easier for the Republicans to bomb him later if they get the chance. But anyway, it's such a false, I can see why it's a good argument politically for getting the thing passed, but it's such a bad argument based on such a false premise that there's some danger at all of Iran's nuclear program here, that something must be done about it. That military action, of course, aggressive war, in other words, a kinetic something, a jargon attack. That's on the table for the Democrats. That just kind of goes without saying now. That's all completely normalized now. They're not so upfront with the regime change terminology these days, but if these talks fail, it sure goes to help reinforce the Hawks' premise that now the only thing we can do, we even let the Democrats try to negotiate with them, and you saw how well that worked. They're crazy, and they're Shiites, and wipe off the map, and yeah, and hate America. And so there you go. I sure would hate to see the Hawks' argument strengthen, that's all, by an attempt to make a deal. I don't know. I guess I got to give Obama half credit for doing the deal as much as he has and pursuing it and trying to keep the Congress at bay, but I don't know. By the way, I mean, it is a bipartisan measure in the Senate. Right now, they're at 59 supporters. It may be veto-proof by the time you hear this, the new sanctions bill against Iran. And Obama said he'd veto it. I guess they would still have to go through the procedure of overriding his veto. Amazing. It could be. And you know what? Again, I'm not very good at the call to action because I don't really believe in it all that much. And I'm not much of a participator in democracy. But I don't know. If you kind of like the idea of the phone ringing in your senator's office or your congressman's office and somebody, if only fleetingly, getting the idea that there are constituents back home who would really like to see this deal done, then and you think maybe it's worth a couple of minutes of your time to do that, you know, hey, I don't know, why not do that? Tell them, hey, staffer, I'm just a lowly old citizen here, don't count for much, but seems to me like this is a pretty good deal to make sure their program stays electricity only and not nuke bombs. Thanks very much. Please don't vote for new sanctions. I like that. Thanks a lot. That'd be so hard. You weren't supposed to sing so loud, Johnny. All right, anyway. That's my point of view. And by the way, Reza Marashi's boss, Trita Parsi, wrote this great piece at Roll Call, Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate. Send that to your senator. See what they think of that. Whose side are they really on here? It's a good one. All right, the occupation when we get back. Which occupation, Scott?
Hey, Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Hey, join up the chat room, man. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Pretty low turnout in there today, guys. Come on. All right, moving on now. U.S. anger at Israel, Kerry comment. Huh? Boy, the BBC, I don't know what the hell their headline writers are talking about, do you? But anyway, I saw this headline and I thought, huh? I would like to understand what they mean by that. So then I read the thing and here's what it says. The U.S. has condemned as, quote, offensive, reported comments by Israel's defense minister about Secretary of State John Kerry's Middle East peace proposals. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki, silent P, right? Said the alleged comments by Moshe Yaalon were inappropriate, given America's support for Israel's security. It was a rare rebuke to America's ally. Mr. Yaalon was quoted by Israel's Yediat Aharonot, Ynet, newspaper, saying Mr. Kerry was acting out of, quote, misplaced obsession and messianic fervor. He said a security plan Mr. Kerry had presented to Israel was, quote, not worth the paper it was written on. Oh. John Kerry, who has come to us determined and is acting out of an incomparable... No, pardon me. Start over. Strike that. New page. John Kerry, who's come to us determined and is acting out of an incomprehensible obsession and messianic fervor, cannot teach me anything about the conflict with the Palestinians. End quote. Mr. Yalon made his comments in private conversations in Israel and the U.S. The Israeli newspaper said Mr. Kerry made a series of visits to the Middle East in recent months and to peace talks. Yeah, a little progress. Yeah. So, now listen. I've got as much contempt for John Kerry as the next guy. That's a test of whether or not you are a decent human being. Whether or not you hate John Kerry. Seems like a pretty fair litmus test. What do you think of John Kerry? Oh, that guy? Ah. If you have anything nicer to say about him than that, then either you're an exceptionally nice person or there's something terribly wrong with you, actually, that would make you blind to his horrible flaws, his numerous horrible flaws, you know, and traits and characteristics and other things. But to have the Israeli smack down the American Secretary of State like this. Hey, wait. I thought that Ehud Barak was the defense minister. Isn't Ehud Barak the defense minister? They're saying that Moshe Yalon. Anyway. It's good to see that the White House pushed back, I guess, the Secretary of State's office. State Department spokeswoman pushed back. At least there's that. But, wow, yeah, anyway. I don't know why they even go along with this raid. I would prefer to have an honest conversation about it. So what are y'all going to do with that over there anyway? Since we know that you don't mean it when you talk about actually negotiating... or anything like independent Palestinian territory there. Let's talk about the future, taking the truth into account now. But nah, let's just, okay, we'll just pretend still. Now, this is interesting. And I'm sorry, I actually haven't had a chance to look at it. It's from tabletmag.com. I only saw the headline. Michael Oren, that's the guy who was Netanyahu's ambassador to the United States up until last October. If peace talks fail, Israel should withdraw from the West Bank. Netanyahu's former ambassador to the U.S. moves to his left. I haven't had a chance to read this yet, but that's interesting. I guess he's not saying... He's saying, listen, if we can't give him a state, we should still get out of the West Bank. That's admirable, although, you know, it can be a double-edged sword. You saw the way Sharon, when he pulled the last of the Israeli Jewish settlers out of the Gaza Strip, it was like taking the last of the Palestinians' human shields away, basically, because then the government of Israel just turned all of Gaza into a prison, like Escape from New York, a prison by the sea or whatever. It's just a gigantic concentration camp. And the situation for the average Gazan is much worse than when there was a minor, you know, settler movement there compared to what's happening in the West Bank. But so, I don't know. Anyway, at least this does show that these issues and what should be done about it and wide and varied plans for what should be done about the future of the Israeli occupation of Palestine is hotly debated over there. Not that you ever hear a fair shake about it in American media, who's who and what it is that they want. Israeli Arab leaders reject land swap plan, which would basically just banish a lot of Israeli Arab citizens and redraw the lines so that the settlers can keep their settlements on the West Bank, and then also the Israeli Arabs will be banished to occupation under the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli so-called defense forces there. Their military, their army. Yeah, what a great deal for them. That's another one at news.antiwar.com. Israeli Arab leaders reject land swap plan. You know, they are crying about the BDS divestment movement, the boycott and divestment and sanctions movement, and saying, why single out Israel? And this isn't original because it's just too obvious, but in case you never heard that reasonable people, maybe not including me, depending what you think, but there are a lot of people who say that Israel's been singled out all along for preferable treatment. Israel's the only country in the world that really has an outright Jim Crow legal system this way. I mean, there's horrible civil wars going on in some countries in the world and whatever, but as far as kind of a permanent Jim Crow segregation within Israel, and then the permanent brutal martial law occupation of the Palestinians on the West Bank and in East Jerusalem and Gaza, there's no comparable situation anywhere in the world, not since the Soviets withdrew from Eastern Europe. So, yeah, Israel's a unique situation. Why single them out? There are a bunch of Jewish Klansmen running the government over there. A bunch of Ku Klux Klansmen running a white supremacy Jim Crow model over their Palestinian helots. So that's why single them out. Oh, and they're doing it all on your dime. You know, you work all week long and you hate your job, but you have to have it because you have to have a job. You have to work. You have to provide for your people that you care about. And then you look at your check and you go, where's my money? They took all my money. The gross and the net, they don't add up. Where'd my money go? Oh, they went to build a colony on the West Bank for some jerk who's going to throw a rock at a little kid for trying to go to school. You know, like it's Missouri in the 50s or something. It's amazing. It's incredible. That's why I single them out, because it's apartheid on your dime. Seems like a good enough reason to me. And when it's funny, it comes to boycott Israel. What does Israel sell other than military weapons? Do they produce anything that they export? You know, other than dishonesty and fear and stuff like that. What do I consume that's Israeli other than Haaretz? But I don't subscribe. I just look at the printer version. Is that a violation of the boycott Israel thing to read Haaretz but not subscribe? Anyway, if anybody knows of anything that Israel's ever produced that anyone wanted to buy on the market, make sure to tell me so that I'll know not to buy that stuff. I'll join your boycott. I'll single out Israel for their hypocrisy. All right, and then, man, look at the time. Oh, it's just not fair. I'll say one more thing for you. Thomas Ricks, who's otherwise known as the mouth of David Petraeus, the PR monkey for David Petraeus, formerly at the Washington Post and now, of course, famously at foreignpolicy.com. He's written a thing saying, the more I listen to American intelligence officials, the more I edge toward Snowden. So here's one of these national security state guys, a full-fledged coindonista who fancies himself all fancy and whatever. And you know what he says in here? He says it is not unreasonable to think that if Edward Snowden had gone through so-called channels, that Obama wouldn't have just killed him, or might have just killed him. He claims the authority to kill American enemies. And here the American government is casting Snowden as the worst enemy traitor of America. You put those things together, and it is a reasonable assumption. They made fun of him for telling Barton Gellman, be careful because the government might kill you over your access to these documents if you're the only one with them and all this kind of thing. That ain't crazy. They'll kill Anwar al-Awlaki's son, Abdulrahman. They could have killed Ed Snowden. That's Tom Ricks talking. That's David Petraeus' lickspittle talking there, saying he was right to run. He's not a traitor. He's a whistleblower on unaccountable power. All right. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. scotthorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And by the way, if you listen to the interview-only podcast archives of this show, you might not know that this show's live from 3 to 5 Eastern Time at libertyexpressradio.com. Every weekday. So now you know. All right. Our next guest is our friend Adam Morrow, IPSnews.net for Interpress Service, who employs him. And he writes for them from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Adam?
Good, Scott. Thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And are you on a speakerphone or something?
I am not.
Okay.
Here, let me move. How does that sound? Is that better?
Yeah, maybe I just have you up too loud over here. I don't know. It's okay. Hey, listen. So today's the big day of the big referendum on the new Egyptian constitution. I guess, first of all, what can you tell us about the turnout? Who's voting? Who's boycotting? What's the big deal? And then maybe we can get into the text of the thing.
Sure. Well, as it stands right now, we saw the first day of voting. It'll be 2 days. There's another day of voting tomorrow. And until now, it's been very difficult to gauge exactly what sort of turnout we're looking at, mainly because all of the local media across the board and much of the international media as well has intentionally downplayed the size of opposition to the Constitution, and have played up public support for the constitutional referendum. So until now, it's difficult. We've seen images on television channels of people lining up on queues, but people have also commented that it's nothing like the size of, or it doesn't appear, at least it doesn't appear to be like the size of the turnout that we saw for Egypt's first post-revolutionary parliamentary election, which was in late 2011. So it was nothing mind-blowing today. I mean, a lot of people were sort of bracing themselves for another June 30th type turnout, which, if you remember, June 30th of last year were the big demonstrations calling for Morsi's ouster, mm-hmm. in which millions of people took to the streets of Egypt. And there was, I mean, no one can deny that there was a massive popular turnout last year for that. But we didn't really see the same sort of thing this time around. Granted, it's only been the first day of voting, and we're going to have another day of voting, and people say we might see a large turnout late tomorrow as sort of all the, like, final stragglers sort of run to the polling stations. But up until this point, it hasn't been particularly overwhelming. Needless to say, the pro-army media is pushing it, is showing all these images of people standing online. All the pro-army newspapers are pumping out headlines that say, you know, Egyptians turn out in massive numbers to endorse the constitution and General Sisi and General Sisi's roadmap for the political future and all of this sort of stuff. But facts on the ground, the numbers weren't particularly overwhelming. And what we can also do is we can also look at how the expatriate vote went, and that was five days last week, during which it looks like turnout was nothing more than between 10% and 15% of Egypt's expatriate community, which I think you're talking about something like 600,000 registered voters who are living abroad, and for that we only saw between 10% and 15% turnout. So up until now, it's very difficult to say, but it's certainly not huge numbers that the government was hoping for.
All right, now I guess the real question is, does it matter? Because the military is going to win this election one way or the other, aren't they?
Well, yeah. Well, that's what everybody's saying, and that was the main motivation for the Muslim Brotherhood and allied groups to boycott the vote, because there was definitely this assumption that, look, it's going to pass either way. The yes is going to be, it's probably going to be in the 80% or 90% in terms of approval, regardless of what the, you know, even if that is a small turnout. So the thinking was, and rightfully, I think it was a right move that, opponents of General Sisi in general and the Constitution in particular have chosen to boycott. But yeah, there's also been increased talk. There has also been a lot of talk recently about the likelihood of vote rigging, especially because a lot of the people who are running the vote right now, who are controlling the polling right now, are the same people that were doing the very same thing during the Mubarak regime, which was famous for vote rigging. I mean, under the Mubarak regime, it was done, you know, blatantly. It was sort of an open secret. Everybody knew. All Egyptians knew that the voting was rigged. But this time around, you've got the same group of people who are back at the controls of who are monitoring the elections. The judiciary, for example, Egyptian judges have been tasked with monitoring the vote, and they are all well-known Mubarak appointees.
Mm. Well, so, you know what? Even without a bunch of ballot box stuffing and that kind of thing, with calls for a boycott, that obviously just splits the vote between the opposition, those who don't bother participating in it at all because it's such a sham, and those who go ahead and try to participate anyway in order to defeat the thing. And so what ends up happening, I guess, then, is they might as well have rigged it, because then they win by such a large percentage. They get to claim a big mandate and popular consent across the board and all of that, and deny the boycott even happen. Or
right,
ignore it.
Right. There's also not a very big international presence. I know the Carter, the Carter Center, which will often send delegations to monitor these elections. They were here for the last batch of elections, which they approved, which they gave their stamp of approval to. This time around, I don't think they were allowed access to it. I think they were actually shut down. I think they're, I might be wrong about that, but they're certainly monitoring it or observing it. They're not going to be there in force like they were last year, and that has kind of raised eyebrows. And then, of course, that's chalked up. A lot of people say, well, you've got this incredible anti-Americanism now going, so a lot of people are saying, like, screw the Americans, who, don't let them observe their elections. They're biased towards the Muslim Brotherhood anyway. You've got this weird dynamic as well. But it all points to. A victory for this constitution either way.
I think that's kind of funny and unique, and maybe too obvious, but I like there's humor that works, the military strategy is that, well, geez, since we're the sock puppets of the Americans, our lead narrative ought to be that the Muslim Brotherhood are the sock puppets of the Americans, and just try to get out ahead of that narrative and just push it so hard that it seems true, like the big lie,
Yeah, it was definitely a masterstroke by sort of claiming the anti-American card, which had been the domain of the Islamists for so long. That was a stroke of genius.
And then that it worked. I mean, hey. Who knew the Egyptian people were so credulous when it comes to that kind of thing?
Well, if anything, Scott, I got to say, if anything that we've seen over the course of the last couple of months, if you can draw a single conclusion to all of the stuff that we've seen, is that the Egyptian people are unfortunately very, very credulous.
There's that new movie, and I'm afraid I didn't see the new movie, but I read a review of it, and it was, in fact, a friend sent it to me saying, wow, this reminds me of your talks with Adam Morrow. because the review, and it, I think it was actually a Council on Foreign Relations guy reviewing it in Foreign Policy or in Foreign Affairs or something like that. But he was basically saying, yeah, these protester kids, they got so into being protester kids, they forgot what the hell they were doing there and what it all meant and whatever. So, for example, last June, July, when there were big calls for everyone to come out in the street to protest the Muslim Brotherhood, the question wasn't just, hey, do you like the Muslim Brotherhood, or it shouldn't have been. The question was, hey, do you feel like being a prop for the military this weekend as they use you as an excuse to overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood and cancel the last elections? That was the question.
Sure.
But instead, these kids are like, yay, come on, let's go protest some more, whatever. Just like young American hippies, basically. You know,
there was a lot of that going on. It was a lot of, like, you know, sort of hyped up kids. Maybe some of them had missed the 18 days, hadn't really had a chance to participate in the 18 days. So we're therefore, you know, sort of looking for a way to establish their, you know, their manly credentials. So any opportunity that arose, and this was particularly the case when Morsi was president, because there were a lot of forces that were actively trying to destabilize Egypt while he was president. And one of the ways that was done was by constantly creating these, you know, these clashes or these protest, these demonstration type situations, where often when you sort of look back at it now, you wonder, you know, was there really a credible reason for people to go out and hit the street? And you realize that a lot of it was manipulation. And stuff has come out subsequently. There was a report that Morsi commissioned when he was president that didn't get released. It basically about some of the clashes between protesters and police in the wake of the revolution, that he commissioned. It didn't see the light of day until recently, until several months after his ouster. It was only like maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, Gazeta finally released a leaked copy of it, and it stated blatantly, explicitly stated that the security services were intended to provoke the revolutionaries, that they were there to provoke them, that they wanted a response. They were trying to draw them out. They were trying to draw them into conflict and violent clashes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And again, and we realize now this was all with the express intent of doing two things: of alienating the Egyptian people from the idea of the revolution. That's a big thing. That idea, that dynamic has played a really, really big role in Egypt after the revolution, is this idea there were definitely forces at work that were trying very hard to basically make the Egyptian people fed up with the instability. They wanted to constantly cause crises and chaos to the point where the average Egyptian would be like, you know what? To hell with this January 25 revolution business. It was better under Mubarak when everything was stable. You know, after 1 year, 2 years of this incessant instability and chaos, a lot of people were sort of saying, a lot of people who had been happy to see Mubarak go and thought he was corrupt, a lot of those same people, and this is like much of the silent majority, sort of come around and say, you know something, it wasn't worth it. You know, after 2 years of this, it wasn't worth it. We want things to go back to how they were. And I think that was one of the big strategies that the counter-revolution used, and one of the reasons why you will get a substantial turnout on this referendum. You know, you are going to get millions of people are going to approve it, are going to vote yes for it, and I would say the vast majority of those are average Egyptians who have just seen all the chaos and have just been like, look, we want a Mubarak-like figure again back to reimpose order, to pass draconian legislation banning street protests, and to just basically put things back to normal, back to pre-January 25th, reality.
Yeah. All right, now, so what about this new constitution? You know what? We don't even have time. We're about to have to take a break here in a minute. So I'll tell you what,
sure.
When we get back from this break, Adam, I want to ask you about what's in the Constitution, the form of the government as compared to the last one.
Sure.
And then, of course, the trial balloons are already leaking. There was a whole contest going on Twitter there for people coming up with puns about CC running for president. Oh, I didn't CC coming. And stuff like that. Anyway, we'll be right back with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net. Live on the phone from Cairo, right after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. And he's a reporter living in Cairo. We're talking about the referendum on the new constitution today. And is this thing just cut and dry, basically just a fig leaf for the new, again, military dictatorship of Egypt, Adam? Or is there more to it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely. And I don't think it's not a new constitution. Also, people need to understand that it's actually an amended version of Morsi's constitution. Because if you remember, under Morsi, they also did a constitutional constituent assembly of 100 members, I think, and endorsed a constitution last year, which was also put before a referendum and passed with a 63.5% approval rating, I think. What we're seeing now, what's being voted on now, is an amended version of that, which actually doesn't. It's not that different. I think there are only 20 or something changes or something like that between the two constitutions. But there have definitely been the power of the army has definitely been expanded, and I know the defense minister is on the position of the defense minister becomes basically immune from any kind of oversight whatsoever, including that of the president for like an 8-year period or something like that. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I saw McClatchy. They said that. I highlighted it in yellow, but it went away somehow. But it was something about CC's position. CC's position being enshrined. Yeah, here it is. It enshrines El-Sisi's place at the top of the military, forbidding his dismissal by anyone other than the country's top military command. So you can have your little president and your little parliament and do your game for TV, but he's going to be the dictator from now on. And then he's saying he's going to run for president anyway. What do you think about that?
The Sisi for president thing has been going back and forth ever since the coup. You definitely get the sense that these are repeated. I think you said it earlier. These are repeated trial balloons where they're trying to get a sense of just what kind of reaction they would get to that. Personally, I think it's the height of stupidity unless these guys actually want a civil war, which isn't entirely out of the question. But you're basically taking the most divisive guy in the country. You know, you're basically taking a guy that, yeah, sure, several million people like love him now and idolize him now, but several million other people, and possibly even more than that, possibly like tens of million people, actually see as a cold-blooded murderer. A good portion of that actually, are holding daily demonstrations calling for vengeance against this guy, calling for this guy's execution. So, I mean, you couldn't pick, really. I mean, honestly, you could not pick a more dangerous or divisive or potentially, destructive person for the role of president. I mean, if the army wanted a front man, they should, they got plenty of other people. They could choose. But Sisi, of all people, it seems almost calculated. Like they want it, that they're just trying to alienate their Islamist constituent even further and drive them to the point of some kind of physical war. I mean, that's On a related note, Ahmed Shafi, if you remember Ahmed Shafi, who was Mubarak's last prime minister and who narrowly lost to Morsi last year, has apparently just come back to Egypt from the Gulf. He's been in Abu Dhabi ever since he lost the election, actually. He's been in Abu Dhabi, and the rumor has it that he's back in Egypt now. So there's also speculation that he might actually, if Sisi doesn't stand, then you have Ahmed Shafi being the sort of the military's candidate. Mm-hmm.
And now, so is it expected that the new parliament will be what basically the same as before, only now no Muslim Brotherhood members will be allowed to be elected under any circumstances, but other than
that's
the
funny.
Will
I mean,
the same
parliament, like you know, the same parliament as before, but no Islamists. The Islamists were 75% of the last parliament, a parliament which remained in place from early 2012 to I think lasted for about 5 or 6 months. Actually, right in the middle of this hotly contested presidential election last year, the army suddenly issued the order to dissolve the parliament based on this obscure sort of judicial technicality about the election. So the idea that you would have the same parliament like last time, only no Islamists, I mean, it's like, this is the big question. If there are no Islamists, who were the only ones who really managed to command any sort of wide, you know, wide-ranging public support, if they're not there, who is the electorate expected to vote for? You know, you've got all these like liberal parties and leftist parties and stuff like that, but they command very little in the way of popular support. So the question really is, I mean, you'll probably get a resurgence of the national Hosni Mubarak National Democratic Party. I think you're probably going to see a lot of those guys who were sidelined, you know, and sort of driven into hiding after the revolution. I think you're going to see a lot of those guys come back into the light. You're going to see a lot of parties, if not a straight up reanimation of the National Democratic Party, you're certainly going to have parties that are just going to be stocked with former members of Mubarak's National Democratic Party. Mm. So that's probably what Egyptians are going to be expected to choose between. So again, we talked about this last time, the idea of trying to eliminate a political current that accounted for 75% of the last parliamentary election, to try to eliminate them entirely from the political scene is going to be a very tall order. I mean, I don't think it really can be done. The way it looks now is, at the very least, even if they do manage to continue the military-backed government, does manage to follow this roadmap that it's called for, which includes constitutional referendum and then parliamentary and presidential elections, even if they do manage to do that, you're still going to have, you know, a low to medium intensity, something that's sort of in between, you know, demonstrations, perpetual demonstrations, and like a low level insurgency. You're gonna have this going on for the foreseeable future, you know, unless they really come down hard, and you know, unless they start killing tens of thousands of people. There's no other way they're going to be able to stop the opposition, the Islamist opposition that's has a street presence on a daily basis until now. Mm-hmm. We talked about how there was some escalation. We've seen some escalations, and those protests, those demonstrations were slowly turning into, although still committed to peaceful protest, we were starting to see police cars and police vehicles getting torched on a daily basis, which is still going on. You're starting to see a lot of demonstrations today. Today, I don't think we mentioned, at least 11 people were killed countrywide when security forces broke up, you know, moved in to break up anti-referendum and pro-boycott demonstrations that were being held around the country. So, there's no, in the foreseeable future at least, I mean, absent, you know, unbelievable repression, Egypt is definitely looking at a period of instability for the short to midterm at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a little bit of sense in a way from the military dictatorship's point of view. If they can, you know, marginalize and radicalize all the Islamists, then that becomes the sort of self-perpetuating excuse for excluding them. You know what I mean?
Right. I think that was the plan from the very beginning. And people have noticed that the behavior of the army after they sidelined Morsi, I mean, they immediately rounded up and arrested all of these guys who are all like elected officials and stuff. They immediately rounded them up and arrested them. And not only that, but they really cracked down on on these resultant pro-Morsi protests, which anybody would have been able to predict. If you're going to do this, if you're going to oust a democratically elected president who's only been in office for 1 year and represents the country's first ever democratically elected leader, of course you're going to have an enormous, there's going to be an enormous popular backlash. It might not be violent, but at the very least, with Egypt's post-revolutionary, sort of fervor, you're going to get huge, huge demonstrations and protests, which is exactly what we saw.
Yeah, it's too bad because it seems like a good strategy could also be, especially post-coup, obviously the military has won not just this round, but they basically won the war here. So why not go ahead and incorporate the conservative old men of the Islamists, allow them to be in the parliament, allow them to participate in the government in a minority, with a minority stake, not with their own president and their own supermajority like it was for a year and a half there. And then, that way to sort of let the pressure out. I mean, I guess it makes sense for them to do it one way or the other, and they seem to be picking the hard way by trying to turn it into a damn civil war.
What you just described was the Salafist Noor Party, which is the single Islamist party that still remains in existence. Why? Because it signed on to the coup. When they had the military coup, the Noor Party endorsed it. It was the one Islamist party that endorsed the coup and sent representatives to the Constituent Assembly to help draft the constitution. These guys, though, I mean, they've lost, from what I can tell. They've lost, unbelievable popularity. They're seen largely in Islamist circles as like the ultimate betrayers, the ultimate betrayers that they basically joined the coup against the democratically elected Islamist president.
I have this terrible feeling, Adam, that it's so important that we cover this in as much detail as we can now, because in the near future, the midterm future, we'll be looking back at right at this time as the context of the horrible developments that'll be going on then. That, remember how it didn't have to be this way, but they made it this way.
I hope that's not the case, but I have to say I do have the feeling that there will come a time in the not too distant future when we do look back at this at the present now and say to ourselves, we never knew how bad it was going to get. I hope it doesn't come to anything like that. And also to the credit of the Islamist opposition,
real,
I mean, they have remained peaceful for the most part.
Right. Very important point to make. The groups doing the fighting in the Sinai, they were already there, and that's not the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Exactly, exactly.
All right. Hey, we got to go. I'm sorry we're all out of time. Thanks very much for your time, as always, Adam.
Sure, my pleasure. Take care, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's Adam Morrow, IPSnews.net, reporting from Cairo. See you tomorrow. Thanks.